Blog Talk Radio. Well, good evening and welcome to Seeking Justice. I am Kim Colton, your host, and tonight we will be discussing the Sean Allison case. Sean Allison, age 29, was found dead in his residence in Lapine, Oregon on November 20, 2000. The apparent cause of death was the result of a gunshot wound. A rifle was nearby. The authorities concluded almost immediately that Sean's death was a case of suicide. However, as additional information came to light, the suicide ruling seemed less and less credible. Joining me tonight is Sean's mother and sister. And I believe I have Sean's sister on the line. I'd like to introduce Rita Allison. Rita?
Hi, Kim.
Hi, thank you for coming on the show. Sorry we got a little late start tonight, but
nevertheless,
we are here. Your mother is not with us as of yet, but I know she is coming on.
Okay.
And I guess we can just go ahead and start. When she comes on, I will introduce her. Rita, would you like to start off the show by telling us what happened with Sean? And with his case?
Well,
if you can start at the beginning of, or even if you'd like to give us a little background.
Well, I mean, just as, you know, I guess events leading up to his body being found is that he's running with sort of an unsavory crowd in the Lapine area, and he had been seeing this woman, girl, who had already had a couple of children by other men, and she winds up pregnant and insists that he is the father of this child. This is where I don't understand his thought processes, but he did go ahead and sign the birth certificate right after the baby was born. Instead of, you know, waiting to do DNA testing, he just believed that it, you know, was his child.
Mm-hmm.
At the point that I don't understand his thinking is that when he was in his early 20s, 20 to 21, he had been in the Marine Corps and suffered testicular cancer and basically was given 6 months to live back then. He beat the cancer with holistic healing treatments, but he was also told that he would never have children. And I think It may have been just the idea that the kid was his, maybe was how she was able to coerce him. You know, because at this point he's 29,
right.
Nobody else has shown up pregnant. He just wanted it to be his kid.
Right. And that does make sense. And Rita, I'll just stop you there because I see your mother is on the phone. And let me please introduce Veronica Allison, Sean's mother. And thank you. Veronica, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm listening.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Okay, Rita.
Thank you.
Take it away. I agree. I think that would be probably just the thought that, oh, I have a child, and maybe not look into it a little further. I can see that.
The jumping into it.
Yeah, right. And that was maybe in the testicular cancer that he had was probably, what, about 5 years prior to this?
Oh, no, eight.
Eight, okay.
Eight. Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah, 8 years.
Okay. Okay, so he has a child with his, or supposedly with his girlfriend, and how is their relationship? What happens there?
Oh, it's not good. As soon as she has his signature on the birth certificate and she gets out of the hospital, she moves back in with an old boyfriend who she has another child with, and this man is involved in some illegal activity in Lapine. And she refuses to let Sean see the baby. Well, the baby was born meth addicted. And I don't know if you're familiar with the problems that children have when they're born drug addicted, but she did have a lot of problems, and Sean wanted to make sure that the kid was taken care of and called the Children's Services Division several times to go to the house to make sure the baby was being cared for. And it's during this time that the boyfriend, Alan Allwood, publicly threatens to blow Sean's head off because Sean's doing this messing around.
Oh, and that's her boyfriend.
Yeah, more than Sean was. I mean, it's more likely
more
that
Sean.
The baby is his child. We don't know who the baby belongs to, actually. We just know the child is not Sean's. We did private DNA. And it basically, with me and the child, and it basically came back almost 100% that I am not her biological aunt.
Okay. Okay, so continue.
So there's the, you know, going back and forth over the child. Sean is court ordered to pay $130 a month in child support. He, at that point, then starts filing paperwork. He's paid a deposit and written a letter to DNA Diagnostics. He apparently is trying to get DNA testing done, and he's trying to go through the Children's Services Division. I think basically he was trying to get his name off the birth certificate, but he never gets a chance to.
Okay.
That this is paperwork that we found that he was in the process of doing, but after his death. He had also been, I don't know why he was doing this, that running off at the mouth thing, but he had told several people that he had a $100,000 life insurance policy and that his dog was the beneficiary.
Oh, he told several people that, correct?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Okay.
And that wasn't a true thing, but I think that was another catalyst that led up to his death. The other factor being that now that he's gone, and because he signed the birth certificate, and there's basically no contesting that, the state agencies, I guess, feel like if a child is eligible for Social Security or VA benefits, that's one less kid on welfare, so they won't even listen to you. The mother now gets about $1,600 a month with the Social Security and the VA payments now that Sean is dead.
So that's a big, big reason to put his name on that birth certificate and to keep it on there.
Oh, absolutely. And she knew he was retired military. She also knew, you know, that because of the testicular cancer and everything that he'd went through, he was being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder. And so the week that leads up to his death, and she's the one that tells us this, that he somehow had ran out of his medication, and she was insistent that he was taking too much of it, and she knew all the technical names for it as well as the slang terms, what they're called on the street. He had never ran out of it before, and if you read the literature about clonazepam and risperidone, I mean, it basically tells you that it is highly inadvisable to go cold turkey. And it's just that week before he dies, and within a few days, mom can tell you exactly when, but a few days after he's found dead, the new prescription shows up.
So I wonder if he actually was taking too much and ran out, or if
she
somebody
took them.
Was taking, she took them.
I think she took them, yes. Because a lot of the story things that, what things that we found out, it's after the memorial service. On the Saturday, he's found on a Monday, the memorial service is on that Saturday. Two of the veterans advocates that had been helping him and their wives came running across the parking lot to tell me and insist that they knew that Sean did not kill himself. Later at the dinner part of the memorial service, it's through my sister and actually face-to-face with Jessica. I mean, she's telling me all kinds of stories. Then I find out later that she had been tormenting Sean with these stories. There had been a body found under a bridge, and its hands were missing. And, there was a big scuttlebutt around town when that happened that it was a mob hit. Because that, cutting people's hands off is not something that just happens. And mm-hmm. Jessica had, she told us that Sean was being investigated for the murder of that person. Well, we find out later that, no, that's not what had happened at all. Jessica was telling Sean that he had committed that murder. And then she was saying something about a dead lady in a field. And we repeatedly asked sheriff deputies about these two deaths and the dead lady in the field. And they didn't know anything about a dead lady in the field. But several months later, they did find a dead woman in a field. And even you go to the sheriff's department and you say, please explain to me how this girl knew there was a dead woman in the field and you hadn't even found her yet.
Oh my gosh.
Both of these dead bodies were found very near Tad's house. And Tad Shirley is the gentleman that
discovered.
And I put it in quotes that he's the one that finds the body on Monday
right.
morning.
Right. And just so our listeners can, Jessica is the girlfriend of Sean, who had a baby girl and told Sean it was his. But
yeah.
later it is found not to be his, but she tells him it is, so she gets his name on the baby's birth certificate.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, okay, just so our listeners are clear who's who. And Alan is Jessica's, I almost want to call him the real boyfriend.
Yes.
And
yes.
she has a child. I know one child by Alan. Are there two? There's two, right?
No, there are four, actually. She has an older boy.
By Alan?
No, just the one boy by Alan.
Oh, okay. And the big thing on getting Sean's name on the baby's birth certificate is so if anything happened to Sean, she would get quite a bit of money monthly to take care so she wouldn't have to work, which seems to me probably right up her alley.
Oh, it's a huge reason. Then also, too, that she was highly concerned about that insurance policy. Every single time we were in court, for any reason, she brought that up repeatedly and tried to talk to Mom about it. She was really nasty at the very beginning. And our story is on, you know, the real crime site, and her handwritten list is an attachment to that story. And, you know, she's written out everything from his glasses and his necklaces to his drums and music equipment. She wanted the rights to the songs that he had written, and the dog is the third thing on the list. We'll see, supposedly the dog was the beneficiary of that insurance policy.
So they thought.
So they thought, exactly.
Okay, so now let's go to the time of the murder. I refuse to call it suicide, frankly, but so let's get to 2000, November 20th, 2000 at 9 a.m. with Tad Shirley.
Well, at 9 a.m., between 9 and 9:15 or so, the Mr. and Mrs. Wards are the neighbors. They live, the lots are acre, 2-acre lots, so, you know, neighbors aren't right on top of each other, but these neighbors are close enough to be able to see Sean's driveway and the front yard area of the cabin that he lived in. And Mr. Ward, in his original statement, says that he is outside, and at this time, the dog, Nikki, runs up to him, which makes him think, oh, Sean's home, because he hasn't seen Sean all weekend. And so following the dog back over there to go talk to Sean, he finds Tad sitting on the front steps, and Tad tells him, don't go in there, Sean shot himself. And whatever takes place conversation-wise there is sort of irrelevant other than the fact that Mr. Ward said that Tad was there between 9 and 9:15. Tad is making phone calls during this period, and what's really odd is that he doesn't call the sheriff's department until 11:36.
Oh, that's quite a
time span to be calling when you found a dead body.
Right.
He calls people that are friends of Sean's, and eventually it's like a kind of a phone train thing. People are calling people. good friends of Sean's that are friends of ours as well were called at 10 or shortly after 10. And they remember that specifically because the girl was watching Regis and Kelly on TV. And it had just started. So it's right around 10 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Through friends, one friend ends up going to my mom's significant other's place of work, tells Joe what happened. Joe takes off work, goes to where mom is working, picks her up. And so they're out to the cabin between 12 and 12:15. Joe always says noon. I think I need to give it 12:15 just for the benefit of a doubt because of what ensues during that little period. Tad calls at 11:36. That's the time listed on Sean's death certificate. That's when they say he died. Yeah, because that's when the body was called in because they did no investigation. They did no autopsy. All of this against Oregon statute. The first officer arrives on scene, Officer Reitman, at 11:54. Now, when Mom and Joe arrive, she is witnessing the body being gurneyed out to the mortician's vehicle, who is a contract person to remove the bodies. What we don't realize at the time, or she doesn't realize, she's stunned, she's in shock, she's been sort of accosted by Officer Decker, is that the body has been released for burial. She's just proceeding on because of what she is told. But even the officer that released it for burial did not have the right to do that. He only had a right to release it to the coroner for autopsy. And then again, the strange thing is that because they're there, you know, 10, 15 minutes. I mean, even if you give it 12,
right.
15, that's 21 minutes they've decided. They've taken pictures. That's it for the investigation. He killed himself. Let's get rid of him. Let's load him up and get it out of here. They had to have called the removal vehicle at the exact same time.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah,
they
for
had
it
to
be there.
Because
an investigation, you know, you're being called to the scene of a dead body. If you don't know what you're coming to, you're going to assume
mm-hmm.
you have to do some kind of an investigation. Could be an hour, could be two. You wouldn't call the removal vehicle the same minute and have it meet you there. Unless
no,
you already
really...
were planning on just open and shut and, yeah.
Right, because you really don't know what's happened until you get there.
Exactly. And then Mom can tell you, you know, what happened, you know, with Officer Decker as her and Joe get to the scene.
Okay. All right. Veronica, do you want to tell us?
It's been so long. I hope I remember it correctly. I just was approached by Officer Decker, and he wanted to know who called me. And told me I wasn't supposed to be told yet.
He was surprised to see you there? To see you there?
Yes, absolutely. And I just said, well, a friend of Sean's called me, you know, and then he proceeded to tell me what happened. And he asked me if Sean ever thought about suicide. And, of course... when he was sick, yeah, he did talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just stunned, you know, they're talking to him. So we just, you know, follow the hearse after that to the mortuary and arrange for, not burial because it cost so much more. I didn't have much money, and
mm-hmm.
we had him cremated, unfortunately.
And that's how we're positive that the medical examiner, Dr. Chafee, never saw the body. And so had no right to sign off on the death certificate, period. But the man has insisted that he did see the body. But we know for a fact that he did not.
No, he couldn't have.
Yeah.
He wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went to talk to him about that, you know, in his medical examiner capacity, he's a state official. You have a right to go see a state official without paying them. He would not
mm-hmm.
see us without making an appointment at his main office. He charged my mom money to see us. He left us sitting in an empty waiting room for 5 hours and, you know, charged us money. And we're there in an official capacity. We're not there to get a physical. He had left his door open, and we heard him talking to someone. And he was saying, basically, they're here, what should I tell them? And
I've made them wait 5 hours and they won't go away, so what should I do? Yeah.
And I'm charging them money and they're going to go ahead and pay the money. Yeah. I mean, that in and of itself, but like I said, again, he can insist that he saw that body all he wants to, but Mom watched it be loaded into the hearse. They followed the hearse to that mortuary, made arrangements for cremation. That body at that time was released for disposal, burial, cremation, whatever. It wasn't scheduled for an autopsy. And under Oregon statute, any death that's not attended by a physician, you know, in like a 24-hour period where it's cancer or something, you expect them to die, or it's not witnessed, it's mandatorily an investigation until that investigation concludes homicide or suicide. And an autopsy is part of that.
And that certainly did not happen.
No, it did not happen.
I want to talk a little. Well, first of all, let's talk. I want to get into where the body was found versus where the blood splatter was. But first, I do want to talk about the dog. The dog was pure white, correct?
Yes.
And Mr. Ward had not seen this dog all weekend, or Sean. And he's
exactly.
got pretty much a bird's eye view right up the driveway into the front of the home. Now, one thing that seemed real odd when you took a second glance at it is that the dog was completely clean. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, that's in trying to speak with Tad about, you know, why he had the dog. And initially, he had come to Mom and said at the memorial service that, you know, he had taken Nikki and that he would keep care of the dog for her because she had a lot to think about. And at the time, Mom was agreeable to that. And this is before we know a lot of what we've just told you about the insurance policy and everything. Tad gives multiple stories about the dog. He says at first that when he gets there, the dog is running in and out of the house, that the doors are open. Well, there's a big pool of blood at the base of the arm of the couch where Sean has bled out. And this dog and that kid were inseparable. Sean used to ride that dog on his bicycle 30 miles. That dog went everywhere with him. That dog would have been grieving. And at the very least would have walked through that blood and made bloody doggy paw prints. But, you know, we think Sean died late Saturday night, early Sunday morning. That dog would have rolled in that blood or something. He would have been,
would
be bloody doggy paw prints, you know.
Everywhere.
He would have jumped
everywhere.
On Sean. Yes, everywhere. When I confront Tad with that aspect of it, then he changes it to, oh, no, he was tied up in the front. Well, A, Sean never tied him up. B, if he was tied up, then Mr. Ward would have seen him and heard him, because if you tied that dog up, that dog went nuts, barking and howling and whatever. And then also, when we find the rope thing in the front yard, Mr. Ward tells us that that was never out there, and it's like a leash and a rope and a chain all jerry-rigged together. It's not even
It looked old. It looked old, too, didn't it?
Well, and it looked contrived. I mean, it wasn't
yeah.
something that you would tie a dog up with, but Sean never did tie the dog up. Okay, the dog's not tied up in front. The dog couldn't have been on the property if the doors were open. If the dog was locked inside, if the doors were closed, it would have been a bloody mess. And if the doors had been closed and the dog was outside, the wards would have seen it. So the only way that this could have happened is that when Sean was shot, the dog disappeared with whoever was there and was brought back Monday morning by Tad. Yes. I don't know that Tad necessarily is the shooter, but he had to have been involved. And then
that dog wasn't there.
No, the dog was not, could not have been on the property until Monday morning. And of course, you know, as soon as Tad opens the door, the dog's going to jump out and went right to Mr. Ward because he was familiar with Mr. Ward. When we try to get the dog back after we start hearing all these other stories, we even contacted the sheriff. They told us to go get the dog. Tad's got like a dozen other dogs. And at this point, he has gotten, and the dog's name just happens to be Nikki, as well as there's a friend named Nikki, so this is a dog. He's had this dog microchipped, and he's insisting that he has spent several thousand dollars on vet bills and that mom can't have this dog back unless she pays him. And this is on top of, he also stole a pickup that belonged to Sean that was in a shop to be worked on. Tad just took it upon himself to go get this truck, and it took us forever to get that truck back, and he charged mom $100 to bring it to her, and it's like, but you stole the pickup, we should have you arrested. But this is how these people are operating. Like, they're going to get every dime out of whatever belongs to Sean that they possibly can. We go out to get the dog. We're in my Suburban. Nikki Tate is with us, and Tad goes ballistic. Had a windshield wiper or a windshield washer thing on a stick, broke that stick on the side of his the railing of his porch, is screaming at me to get off his property. Mom and I back away and go across the road. It's a one-lane road. We've called the sheriff because they say, if he won't give you the dog, call us and we'll make him. One sheriff deputy is standing next to Tad, and one is with me and my mom in front of the Suburban. And Tad is screaming obscenities at us, and finally lets go with, you effing bitches, you let him lay out there for 2 days. You didn't care about him. And as soon as I heard that, I rounded on him and said, what do you mean we let him lay out there for 2 days? How do you know that, Tad? And he starts stuttering, and he's like, the sheriff told me. And I said, the hell he did. There was no autopsy. They listed time of death as when you called in. And at that point, the sheriff insists that we leave. So they make us leave. And
without,
I pull over.
Without the dog,
exactly. I pull over a mile or two down the road, and mom said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm going to make them write down what Tad said. When we start confronting the sheriff's deputies about what had occurred, the one that is standing next to Tad says he didn't hear a thing. And the one that was talking to us said, I didn't hear what Tad said. I heard what you said back. But Nikki, who is inside the Suburban with the windows rolled up, heard both sides of that conversation.
You're trying
and
to
so
get
how
them
did
to...
Tad know that he died two nights earlier?
Right. Right, and you would like confirmation that the police heard him say that, but now the police are saying they didn't hear a thing.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. Okay. Okay, so, well, let's see here. Let's get on to, before we go any further with the dog with Tad and Alan, let's just talk a little bit about the crime scene itself. This was a very unusual crime scene. I have the diagram here, and there was a lot of blood splatter and on the refrigerator. It's a fairly small. It's almost a one room as you're looking, as you come in the front door, correct? It looks like it's a one room, and then towards the back, it looks like there's some stairs that pull down to a loft.
Yes.
And the blood splatter looks to be in the middle of the room, kind of towards the, I guess you would say, towards the kitchen area. Is that true? Clean to the top of the ceiling and
yes.
Stop at ceiling. Yeah. And there was some on the refrigerator. And where else? Lots of blood on fridge. There's blood on the front of the lower cabinets were covered in blood. And this is the kitchen area. Now, the strange part about this is that the couch where Sean's body was found was on the absolute opposite side of the home.
Exactly.
So you have... Excuse me, Mrs. Allison?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure I hear, you know, if you have anything that, you know, just pipe up. So Rita, the blood is all over the kitchen area, and yet his body is found on the opposite side of the room on the white, may I say this is a white couch, and there is absolutely zero blood spatter on the table next to the couch, on the books on the table, on the wall behind the couch, on the couch itself. There is absolutely no blood splatter, just the blood from where Sean bled out from the head wound, correct?
Exactly. And that table is a very thick white, it's a Bible actually, but it's a big one. And, I mean, that's like the one of the first things that jumped out at me. That book can't be but a few inches from where his head is resting on the couch. And, you know, to think that if and that's the other thing, because there was no autopsy we've gotten from several different police officers, some of them say that he put the gun on his cheek, some say he put the gun in his mouth. We don't even have a definitive answer, but it would be on the left side of his face. The right side of the back of his head is what is gone, and his head is resting in that, you know, upper area of the couch. Still, that mm-hmm. blowout would have covered that book and that table and that wall and the arm of the couch and everything, but it's not there. Yeah.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Where he
Most.
Just said he bled out.
Mm-hmm. And tell our listeners where the gun was found.
The gun is leaning up in the opposite corner on the arm, opposite corner of the couch. The barrel is pointed up, but his feet are up on the gun.
Yeah, his feet are they're covering, his feet are on the gun. The gun is underneath his feet.
Yes.
So this is the scenario the cops or the investigating officers would like you to believe, is that he shot himself in the kitchen, and this was a horrific head wound. It horrific.
It was horrific.
That side of his has gone.
Yes.
But he managed to walk over to the couch and lay down. And before he laid down, of course, he dropped the rifle, sort of, put his propped his feet up on it, and laid down. And that's what the police want you to believe.
Well, they never really ever explained anything. Mom
well,
can
that's
tell
true.
You. Well, and then see, Mom's significant other Joe, because they'd said suicide, and boy, you know, you're trained from a little kid to believe that the cops are the good guys, they're going to do the right thing. We never had one second of doubt that they weren't doing their job. And I think that's one of the biggest points why a lot of us on Real Crimes, especially, you know, keep trying to get our stories out there. You can't imagine what is possible to happen and not happen until it happens to you.
Correct.
And
correct.
So,
and I do want to just mention that website. It's www.realcrimes.com. And it's a group of, like you say, it's a group of family members who have lost loved ones, and they need help. They need answers. They did not get closure. They, for different reasons. It's a wonderful website.
Well, the common thread of the reasons is that the police agencies in every single case did not do their jobs. And in half the cases, the police officers were either involved in the crime itself or then are later arrested for other crimes.
Well, that's a whole nother ball game. We're going to get
yes,
into
it
that
is.
Story.
Yes. No, I know, but
that.
Because
yeah.
we were getting all these stories that, you know, people insisting that he did not kill himself, and the more you're trying to put the stories together and, you know, again, it's like, if it was a suicide, nobody would be lying about anything, but that's all we got from the people that were surrounding him was lies, and they couldn't keep their story straight. So you start writing stuff down, and you can go back and say, well, they told us this a month ago. Look what they're telling us now. Mom, mm-hmm. finally, Joe had went in and removed the couch. He just didn't want Mom to have to deal with that. He thought he was doing a good thing, went in and kind of cleaned things up a little bit and, you know, got rid of the couch and stuff so she didn't have to look at it. But then Mom has Captain White, and I don't remember, Mom can tell you how many other officers were out there, and she can tell you that, you know, what was said and about where they think Sean was when he was shot. That's when we hear for the first time that they give an opinion about where he was when he was shot.
I see. I see. Because they never tested anything. They didn't test DNA on the gun, nothing, because there
nothing.
Was just nothing was tested. Nothing was gone over. No forensics in the home.
No, no blood patterns, spray, no gun residue on his hands. I mean, nothing. The only
right.
thing they did was take pictures. And again, like I said, you know, I mean, Joe wants to say they were there at noon, and I'm giving it the benefit of a doubt, because if they were there at noon, that means from the minute the deputy's foot hit the driveway, there was 6 minutes before they had that body loaded up and in the hearse and were leaving with the body.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they went out there with no intention of doing an investigation.
Right.
Well, those two cops were the ones that were arrested. The two main investigating officers
mm-hmm.
were the ones that were arrested for other crimes later down the road.
Right. And let's talk about that now, then, Rita and Veronica. The investigating the officers, along with many other officers in this, how big is that town anyway? What is the Lapine?
I'm unsure how many people are there.
Well, what you're talking about, Deschutes County for sheriff
mm-hmm.
deputies,
mm-hmm.
and Lapine is just.
Lapine.
Well, but she's talking about how many
about
people. Yeah, for the
county,
because Deschutes County.
It's not huge.
No, Lapine is like 30 miles from Bend, and then Redmond and Sisters are 14 or 18 miles away. So there's a few little communities that surround Bend, and, you know, there's probably maybe 250,000 people in the county, maybe a little more.
Okay. And out of all that with the Sheriff's Department, how many have been, I mean, it's mind-boggling to me to read or hear about
107 Sheriff's Department employees, most of them having been deputies, not just office workers. Most of them were deputies, have been arrested, accused of, but most of them convicted of other crimes, including the sheriff at the time for the entire county, the main sheriff. He was arrested for embezzling $500,000 from the Sheriff's Department and the Sisters Rural Fire District. And while he was doing time in Nevada, he was also arrested and convicted for selling Sheriff Department rifles.
Yeah.
Then these two men.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Every time we bring up the story, we see something, read something, hear something. Yes, Reitman is a sheriff's officer, but he's the dog control officer. And that's the first officer on the scene at a death investigation. They sent
the
dog catcher.
Control.
Yeah.
Oh.
But it's him
My
and
goodness.
Malloy is the second one on scene. Those two are later, and Malloy is the DARE officer, the one that's supposed to be teaching kids not to do drugs. He
that's
gets
right.
sisters that are under 17, and between the two of them, they have given the girls a variety of different drugs. They have had sex with them, and they are in the process of, they're going to put porno videos of them on the internet at the time that the two officers are basically, you know, arrested for it.
Wow. You know, I can't help but think that any thing that these, any investigation that these two were in control of should have been reopened.
I agree totally.
Just because.
just because, exactly. I mean, was like Malloy was convicted. It was like 147 counts of, you know, various things. That I think the thing that makes my mom and I the sickest is that, you know, talking to people in Lapine or whatever, you get a sense that if the Sheriff's Department isn't directly involved in the drug distribution out there, they are turning a blind eye, because that's the economy. And we point blank get told that they're not going to do anything about it because it will collapse the economy of that town. And you can tell that the good people that live out there are afraid of the criminal element as well as the sheriff's department. We hear that two officers that were involved in this were actually living with women that were distributors of methamphetamine. And
Decker and Malloy.
Decker and Malloy. We went to the attorney's office at least 10 times and brought this up, and why aren't you doing anything about it, and just constantly, you know, being a thorn in their side. The next thing we hear is that they have moved out of these women's houses, and the two women get arrested. Now, if the DA had done something when we reported this in early to mid 2001, what happened to those girls wouldn't have happened, because they don't start doing this with the girls until late 2001, early 2002, and they're not actually caught until almost 2004.
Wow.
But they made the parents of those girls' lives a living hell. They gave up their business, and they've moved out of the area. I think they're even considering moving out of state. These officers, I mean, clear up till the day they actually put these guys in jail or took them off of duty or whatever, they'd pull them over and threaten to plant drugs on them. They were threatening them with false arrest. I mean, the parents actually sued Deschutes County. I don't know how much they got. That wasn't disclosed, but it was for several million dollars, their original suit.
Wow. Well, I hope that that just gives you an idea. That really gives just a tiny little bit of insight, really, into what you and you both endured during this time with Sean's murder, dealing with these officers.
Yeah. One point that is that I wanted to make is that Sean I was told that he knew all about these things, and he had made arrangements to go to a rehab because he thought maybe nobody would believe him. But he knew a lot of things about the drug trade up there, and he was going to tell on them after he came out of this rehab. He didn't do drugs, but he did drink. And so that is another...
So you're saying that Sean was aware of some of these things with the police?
Yes, because this girl knew everything, too.
Jessica?
She was one of the biggest. She bragged about being a seller of meth up there. I hired a detective after this happened, not too long afterwards. And those two detectives are the ones that told me the story. They brought me to Lapine, and they said, we can't really take your case, because if we did, we could never work in this area again. And they told me that the sheriff's department turns their head to the drugs up there.
Wow.
And they're very protective of each other. I mean, the one officer that was assigned to, you know, field our concerns or whatever was getting sick of us. And basically, he screamed at mom, you know, he killed himself. Do you want me to show you how he killed himself? That's not a very professional way for a police officer to behave. Mm-hmm. And then he later goes around to the people that are telling us stories. Like, we would hear things, we would give him the information thinking he's going to do something good with the information. He went to those people and told them to shut up.
Oh,
and so they did. They shut up.
Yeah, they said they never said it afterwards.
Or they changed their stories. But, you know, this is like a nightmare, because you're dealing – this is the sheriff, and the sheriff is going around telling possible witnesses to a murder, or to, you know, things that led up to a murder, to shut up.
Mm-hmm. And who was it that said, don't stir up those women?
That's Penzenic.
Okay.
That's Officer Penzenic.
Yeah. Sounds like something out of a bad movie. The women.
It is definitely a made-for-TV movie. It's,
yeah.
You know, the amazing thing is that, speaking of the made-for-TV movies, there's been quite a few of them made. There's also been several stories on, you know, the crime shows on TV. It seems like there is an awful high rate of either men in the military or men that have gotten out of the military that have some kind of a benefit that will benefit a person, that then the guy ends up dead. There seems there's an awful high rate, like Sean, you know, $130 a month or $1,600 a month. Let's see, you know. And
right.
your world is already based in drugs and crime. I'm sure she didn't think a thing about taking him out.
Oh no, I'm sure not. And I'm sure her boyfriend, or this Alan, and this is just conjecture on my part, but that he was probably delighted to also receive that $1,600 a month because they were living together, right? Or did
that
you not know that
had
for
I
sure?
Not- No, they were living together. That would have happened had I not stepped in, and I wanted to get DNA for the child. And so we went through a big round of court, and they brought her in, and she was found to be unfit mother. One of the grandmothers of the other child, her other child, helped me, and we both, you know, wanted her clean. So they sent her to rehab, not once, but twice.
And that is part of the rehab and getting the kid back and all that kind of stuff, that she had to stay away from the people that she was involved with in Lapine.
Right.
So she ended up,
Alan has another girlfriend and she's somewhere else. So
we did make her life a little uncomfortable early on.
Mm-hmm.
But we had two choices: push for the DNA thing and have absolutely no contact with the child whatsoever. That was because then we proved that we weren't related. But, you know, here's this innocent kid that did not ask to be brought into this world, let alone the way that she was brought in. And, mom was attached to her, you know, and she's grown into a very fine young lady. She's nine years old now. We're right around the corner from eventually she's going to know. She's going to have to know.
She asks all the time. She wants to know.
What does she say?
She can't stand it she can't stand it that she has no father. I mean, the man that Jessica lives with now seems to treat her pretty well, and she calls him daddy now. But there was a point in time when she was like 4 years old, the kids would tell her other siblings, would tell her, you have no father, you know, you have no family. And so finally I just made Jessica. I said, you know, you've got to control these children. Because she didn't want to go home for Christmas 1 year. She wanted to stay with me. And so they did have like a little family thing, but it's worse now. See, we've gone through the Sean thing, and now we're going through Alexis thing. So.
Right, and really, you could have. Let's just recap that for our listeners too. Alexis is
Sean's daughter.
Sean's daughter.
He is
her
legal father, but that's it.
Because he signed the birth certificate, yes.
Because he signed the birth certificate. And now, really, just because you have such big hearts, you couldn't turn your back on this little girl who was born, the baby who was born meth addicted, and obviously has, you know, not the best
mother
in the world.
A negligent
mother. A negligent mother, and your hearts went out to her, and you decided not to pursue the DNA testing, which would have cut off Jessica's fund money that she got for Sean's death. But instead, you said, you know what, the daughter, this little girl, is more important than that, and I have to applaud you for that. I really do. Because she's a human, a little human being who didn't ask to be brought into this situation, and
she needed an advocate. That little girl was abused. If it wasn't for mom, I hate to think of what could have. I mean, we think that she has been abused some, and we're talking child abuse with like sex things, but without mom's influence.
We just think it because of things she said to me
when she was really little. But, you know, she knows that she's got mom as a backup kind of thing, and Jessica knows that mom is in the picture. I'd hate to think what would have happened to this child if there had been no one.
Oh, I can't imagine. I can't imagine what her life would have been like. And, you know, and Sean, didn't he at one point ask you to take care of her?
That was the note that was left, whether that was his, what they called a suicide note, or was he trying to tell us something? We don't know, you know, we don't know.
Right.
Well,
you don't
yeah,
know.
Because, you, well, that note, that's the other thing. That note is found on the countertop where the majority of the blood splatter is. It had to have been placed there after, because there's not a drop of blood, and it's on the back of an envelope. And
yes,
I mean, the counter, the microwave, the wall, the cupboard doors, everything is covered. There is nothing on this note. And the note isn't, I mean, it says, you took out an innocent man. You know, tell my mom I love her, and it's basically telling mom to take care of my dog and my daughter. It's not saying I'm doing this because I can't live in the world anymore. And without me saying that to the, you know, Lois on Real Crimes, I mean, she finally, when she'd had a chance to go through everything, several other people, I don't say it right off the bat. I let them come to their own point. They always say, oh, my God, that's not a suicide note. That's him trying to tell you somebody's killing him. And even the man that did the handwriting analysis, because at first, Jessica's writing is close enough, we thought that maybe she could have forged it. The man did say it was Sean's handwriting, but he said he's been doing this for 30 years, and it's not like any suicide note he has ever seen.
Mm-hmm. And just the fact that it was found with no blood on it in an area swimming in blood is very suspicious.
One other point, excuse me.
That's fine.
When Tad brought the truck that he had stolen to me, I had talked with him for a little while, and still, you know, we didn't know a lot of this stuff. I was mad at him for making me pay $100 for my son's truck and all that. But I said to him about the note and how I thought it would, what didn't sound like a suicide note, and he said, oh, that's an old note. See, now how would he know that?
How would he know that? Yeah.
How would he know anything about the
thing.
Note? How would he know that we let him lay out there for 2 days?
Right.
See,
oh, I wanted to ask. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to ask, what was Tad and Sean's relationship like?
They were buds.
Were they? They were
they
buds.
They were buddies. And, but I read what Tad said about him. He said he was a pain in the ass. That's what he said.
Yeah, you hear conflicting stories, like they were friends, but then you also hear that Tad would do things like try to sell Sean rigs that were really junk. You know,
yeah,
it was,
he wanted his money.
I mean, you're looking at a group of people that, you know, they're running drugs, they're using drugs, their whole mindset is criminal.
Can you tell her about what we just found out about him? Or is that not possible?
It's public knowledge. See, and I had told you this on the phone the other night, not long after, and again, you know, we feel like they've covered all their bases. Jessica's got the baby, signed birth certificate. I think that was planned even before they decided to kill him. I think so. During one of the court cases, Alan Allwood even stood up in court and declared that the kid was his. He didn't say, I think it might be. He said the kid is his, and the court system even ignored that.
They ignored it.
But I think when they found out that she was pregnant, it was just whoever they could have coerced into signing that birth certificate, they would have, just for child support. It would be extra money, even if it was Alan's kid. He obviously didn't care who was on the birth certificate. But right afterwards, so now Tad's got the dog, Jessica's got the baby, Jessica's thinking she deserves all of Sean's everything, and whoever, the kid or the dog, one of these people would get that $100,000 life insurance policy. It's like they've got it made in the shade kind of thing. So I don't know what occurs when they finally figure out that, no, that insurance policy, mom was the beneficiary and it wasn't that much money. But Tad shows up with two brand new towing trucks. He had a tow company. And the way things had worked in this county up until this point is that any police service calls, when the police had to call a tow company, they rotated it with every tow company in the county. You know, everybody got a little piece of that pie. Tad shows up with two brand new tow trucks and somehow gets the county contract. for all the tows.
Wow.
And I mean, we're talking $150,000 trucks each. When, you know, they're brand new and they're all tricked out. They're like the top of the line tow trucks. In just the last couple of years, he has lost that business. He's ended up divorced or whatever, but he's looking at, and I don't know how it ended up, but I did find it in the records. It was felony coercion, and it was attached to car theft and assault and burglary and theft. There was a whole list of people. So, and that's the other thing. I don't remember, and Mom doesn't either. It was like this. There was this big, huge thing that took place, and we never read about it in the paper at all.
Holy cow. I find that odd. It wasn't in the paper. But
well,
maybe
you know,
he'll
like
go away for a.
Well, we don't think so. No, I mean, if
well,
he did do some time, he's out now.
He is out now.
Mm-hmm. And it's like with the family that had the daughters that the police officers were involved in with and that sued the county. The way that they were harassed, you know, clear up until those men were basically put in jail, but. Part of what they ended up finding out was that because they were going to the sheriff's department and complaining about these men. Somehow their complaints and any paperwork that was attached to the harassment charges that they were trying to file kept disappearing.
Wow. Amazing, isn't it?
It's mind-boggling.
It's frightening is what it is.
It's extremely
mm-hmm.
frightening.
It is frightening. You're right, Veronica. It is frightening that to know that can go on, but Sean, or excuse me, Tad no longer has that business. And is he still in the area?
He is still in the area.
Last time we heard.
Right. And Jessica is, well, she's obviously in the area, and you do see little Alexis.
She's going to school. She's going to be a nurse of some sort.
Oh, wow. So she's kind of turned herself around a bit. Do you feel
yes.
that she has? Well, that's nice.
I don't think she's involved in drugs. I don't know, but she mm-hmm. is going to school, and she seems to be doing okay, or they wouldn't keep, you know, letting her progress, would they?
No, right.
The one thing about Tad, because Jerry Berry came down here and he actually spoke with Tad, and here we are, you know, almost 10 years, we're 9.5 years down the road. He had told Jerry that he doesn't sleep well at night and he has to take pills to sleep because he sees Sean.
Well, that's telling, isn't it?
You know, unless you had a guilty conscience, it's like Jessica going through my sister at the memorial service. And first she says she hadn't seen Sean in a couple days. And then, like I said, this is prior to me. I don't really know anything. I just know that the veterans advocates have came to me in a frantic panic thing, telling me that things are not good and that Sean did not kill himself. And so now I'm getting all these stories. It was like, I don't know, the more she talked, the more she hung herself kind of thing. And, you know, I'm starting to think, well, you know, Saturday night, early Sunday morning, he could have died. But then later it comes through that, oh, no, she hadn't seen him in 5 days. Well, mm-hmm. after we complained about the way Penzenic treated Mom, they gave her Detective Utter. And Detective Utter actually did find out that Jessica and Sean had dinner on Saturday night in La Pine. And so that makes her the last person to see him alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then
she tried to cover that up.
She totally tried to cover that up prior to us even really suspecting anything. And then there's the... Mom had written down all the people that had called Sean's caller ID. And about 3-4 o'clock that Sunday morning on the 19th, Tad calls the house several times. And the thing that has always bugged me, and Jerry said it, and there's another retired officer that's actually looking at the case, and he said the same thing to me, that there is a chance that Sean didn't die immediately. And it just makes me sick to my stomach. You can only hope that he was brain dead. Well, because of the massive bleed out, that like his heart was still going. And it's what makes me think is that people were there waiting. She brought him back. They shot him. They couldn't shoot him more than once and have it look like a suicide. If he was still breathing, whatever, they somehow get him to the couch. The phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning, I think, was Tad guilty conscience for having left him there and seeing if someone or him or whatever might answer the phone.
Wow, that's...
It's too suspect, you know, and at some point, things are not coincidence any longer.
Exactly. That's very true, Rita. I hate to think that he suffered for any amount of time. I can't imagine.
I don't think he was aware. You know what I mean?
I don't think so. Either.
And I hope and pray that he wasn't. I mean, it is possible but it's because, I mean, he literally bled out. But the other thing was, you know, what made me start thinking, they had tried to take a blood sample is what they said, and they were unable to because the blood had already congealed in his extremities. And, I called an emergency room doctor and talked to a mortician and said, you know, how long is a body, you know, dead laying there before you can't draw blood anymore? And the time frame, there's no way he was shot Monday morning. There is no way he died Monday morning. It had to have been 24 to 48 hours for that blood to have congealed.
Mm-hmm. And also, I don't... go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Tad screaming at us. You let him lay out there
right.
for 2 days.
Right, right. Yeah, that's something you won't probably ever forget, I'm sure.
No.
But I don't have the picture in front of me of the couch of where when he's laying on the couch, but doesn't it almost look, to my memory, I'll see if you agree here, that he was possibly moved like you would carry someone under their arms, like if
yes.
someone lifted him up under their under his armpits and grabbed him and pulled him around the coffee table and up onto the couch.
Yes.
Is that... Okay.
Yes,
I thought
and
that's what I remembered from the picture.
Several of the gentlemen that have looked at this case have said that to me. That it looked like he had been grabbed under his arms and pulled up onto that couch and let go. And you know, the other thing is that the shirt he's got on is completely and totally white. That's another weirdness, that there's no blood on that shirt. But it's the kind that it's the baseball sleeve, and the sleeve is like a dark blue color.
Mm-hmm.
He also used to wear, you know, like they call them logger shirts, like a flannel, you know, button-down
mm-hmm.
shirt, but he'd wear them over those. And that was how he
mm-hmm.
always dressed, and he's not wearing one. So it makes me think that he had one on when he was shot. Whoever moves him takes that shirt off of him in case they, you know, DNA, they've got
oh,
hair,
of course.
You know, something on that shirt. Because the shirt is so conspicuously white, the couch arm... You know, is more a tan
oh,
color,
white.
But still very light colored, and that
mm-hmm.
book. And for
yes.
such a massive injury, for none of those very glaringly white things to even have a dot of blood on them is just so suspicious.
Oh, it's very suspicious, and I don't think he got up and walked over there. So.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that they do say in the police report, when they moved his body... there was a bullet found under him. When Mom went to get the gun, she asked for the bullet and the bullet casing, and she was told that it somehow disappeared. It's mysteriously
oh.
gone.
Yeah. That figures. Well, I guess all I can, I just kind of wanted to now touch base with you, Rita, about if you think it's time to discuss, I asked you a question, what are your anticipations or the results you would like to achieve by appearing on the show? And you gave me a terrific answer that I would like our listeners to hear, if you want to kind of go
you know,
into that a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, certainly. You know, again, it's like I said earlier, you know, Mom is called to the scene. She's told her son is dead. You know, you're in shock. It doesn't matter how they died. You're not thinking clearly. You're just in shock. But adding to that and compounding that is that you're trusting the police. And you
mm-hmm.
don't know what can go wrong. And it's like, you know, at the point where she followed the hearse to the funeral home, the body's been released. She arranges for cremation. You know, then we find out down the road, and it's too late now to get an autopsy because he's cremated. If we had known this kind of thing did occur, and actually occurs way more frequently than one would suspect, she would have could have insisted, you know, on an autopsy, could have insisted on more of an investigation, the ballistics and the whole thing. But nobody is in that frame of mind ever until mm-hmm. it happens to you. And when it happens to you, it's too late. And the thing about them designating a death a suicide, that's it. It is a brick wall, closed door, you're done. You would much rather have it be undetermined because it allows,
right.
There's a leeway, there's a, you know, a scope there that you can force people to try to help you keep a case open, you know, keep, you know, bugging people. But once that suicide designation is on that death certificate, you're done. And I was hoping that Barb Thompson was going to call in. She was able to take a series of steps, and she would be able to explain them better than I was able mm-hmm. to get the suicide reversed on her daughter's death certificate. And now the mm-hmm. a corrupt coroner, you know, he's got the right to make it undetermined or homicide. And I'm thinking, she was shot in the head, and it's not suicide. So it's determined that how she died, that would make it a homicide. You know, but you're relying on these corrupt medical examiners and police forces to do the right thing. I guess just keeping Sean's story out there, you know, my hope is that eventually, and that's where it would have to start, I'm going to have to figure out a way to get the suicide ruling reversed. And that's go ahead.
Well, I was just going to interject that how difficult it is to get that suicide ruling removed once it's there. And depending on what state you live in, and again, you mentioned Barb Thompson and her daughter. You can read about her daughter's case. Her daughter's name was Rhonda Reynolds, and that also is on the Real Crimes website. And given this different state that you may be in, things can be different and how it's handled to remove that suicide label. And,
exactly. So I can't take the steps that she took because there are a couple of Washington statutes that provided for her to go after the coroner. There's no Oregon comparable statute. Mm-hmm. And we're side by side. There's another case that just got posted, Fitzgerald. It's a brand new one. His first name's Paul. But what happens in that case is that the officers that are involved, and they are actually believed to be involved in the shooting of this man, they were supposedly friends, but they do what's called the Garrity Law. The police officers carry this card around, and they write this information on any statement that they make concerning a case that they may be accused of or involved in. And at the juncture where they invoke that Garrity Law, it's like pleading the fifth. Nothing they say in that statement can be used against them in any venue. And so the case was all muddled and mixed up, and, you know, the family is saying that Garrity Law needs to be repealed. Well, any law that prevents you from finding out what really happened to a loved one, especially in a case like Sean's where there's too many questions and the majority of the police officers that were involved have been convicted of other crimes. You know, that should be an automatic reversal and open investigation. I mean, there's got to be something federal that encompasses, you know, the entire United States because, again, it's, you know, yes, Barb has had an amazing result. It's taken her 11 years to get where she's at, though.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens a lot of times, I mean, people just give up. You give up. You're either threatened, you're scared to proceed, you know, I mean. Or
mm-hmm.
that you run out of money because it's expensive to do, you know, lawyers and courts and private investigators. And
mm-hmm.
really, I mean, in these situations, the families have almost no recourse.
Mm-hmm. And that's true. And what bothers me, this bothers me, is that to imagine, Veronica, to imagine you coming upon this scene, my heart goes out to you, and then that police officer asking you, has he ever threatened suicide in the past? You say yes, but he doesn't give you a chance to say, It was 8 years ago. It's just cut and dried.
You're right. And also, just the thing of him asking me what it was I doing there, it was like it took me aback, you know?
Right.
And when your mouth is open to begin with, you don't even know what to say or do.
Well, yeah, because he meets her at the end of the driveway. Who are you?
Yeah.
She identifies herself. And then he's like, they weren't supposed to tell you. Who's they? And it's Oregon statute that you have to notify next of kin, or don't you know what you're doing here? You're the one with the badge. That, you know, again, that the hearse being there that soon had to have been called the minute that they got the notification that the body was being turned in. Meets them out there, and literally between 6 and 21 minutes at the most is done an investigation before that body is. And I mean, technically, I don't know how long it takes to load a body into a body bag and on a gurney and wheel them out. That's got to be 5-6 minutes right there all by itself. The time frame is mind-boggling.
It is. It is. And you know, I think when Veronica, when that officer yelled at you, it almost seems to me, and I've heard this before, it's almost what I believe to be a tactic to get you to totally back off.
Yes,
stop.
He was trying to scare me, yes.
And who wouldn't be scared? Who wouldn't be intimidated? I certainly would be.
I was intimidated, and I didn't know how to even react to that. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I should have gotten angry. I should have gotten angry, you know, when he asked me what I was doing there. I should have insisted on seeing him, but I don't know. It's like I always do things backwards, I guess.
But the more
you think
about that, it's almost like there's a double entendre there in that I'll show you how he killed himself, but does he also mean I can shoot you just like he was shot? I mean, you don't know what these people are thinking because they certainly are not acting like officers of the law sworn to, you know, protect and uphold their duty.
Right.
Well, he's very angry, for sure.
Mm-hmm. We do have a question in the chat room, and I just want to clear this up because maybe a few other people might not have totally understood this. But she asks, this may be a question asked and answered, but why no autopsy? Could we go over that one more time, Rita?
Said, go ahead, Rita. You tell.
Well, again, you know, my thinking is that the sheriff deputies that arrive on scene, the ones that are out there, have a background of being involved in drugs, and I'm not so sure that one or all weren't there when he was killed because of the time frame of, you know, Tad sits there for 2.5 hours and calls people, and we brought that up repeatedly, and nobody finds that odd. Oh, people react to finding a dead body differently. Nobody sits and waits and calls everybody in your cell phone for 2.5 hours before you call the police. I don't care who you are. Unless you're trying to figure out what you're doing. And it seems to me that the police arrive knowing full well that they're just going to declare it a suicide and get that body out of there as soon as possible. Decker oversteps his boundaries, and that's something that I need to check into, but I haven't. If he's there as an investigative officer, it may be a conflict of interest that he also acted in the capacity of the deputy medical examiner. But under Oregon statute, the deputy medical examiner can release the body from the scene, okay, to the coroner for the autopsy, but he cannot release the body for burial. What happened there, they've got guilt written all over them that they didn't follow correct procedure in what they did. Later, because we made such a big stink, you know, mom did get the cursory little pat on the head and the patronizing, well, rest assured that from here on in, any similar case, you know, those people will receive an autopsy. Still, you broke the law. They broke Oregon statute. Because Decker had no legal right to release that body for burial. He did so because mom followed the hearse to the funeral parlor, made the arrangements. If it had been released to the coroner, the funeral director would have said, I'm sorry, we can't make funeral arrangements until the coroner does the autopsy. That's not what happened. The other weird thing is that, was it 3 months later, Mom, that It was right after we went to talk to Chafee. We went to the funeral parlor to talk to that person, and it was under new ownership, and the new owner sort of acted freaked out about us even being there and had told us that he had no forwarding information for the original mortician. Don't you find that odd?
Yeah.
I mean, that guy got the hell out of Dodge. And no forwarding information. I mean, what if the guy had a question about the business? Don't you think you'd kind of stay on as an advisor?
Something. Yeah.
I just think it's odd that the guy disappeared off the face of the earth.
Oh, that is so strange.
You know, other strange things like Mommen had made up flyers. You know, say we're completely off the wall. Sean did commit suicide. We just refused to believe it. We want information about his murder. Nikki and Mom go out to Lapine, tack up these posters all over, put some here in Bend. If it really was a suicide, would anybody really care if we put up posters or not? Well, somebody obviously cared because somebody took the time right after they hung them up to rip every single one of them down, and they knew who put them up because the next morning Nikki found some of them crumpled up on her porch here in Bend, 30 miles from Lapine.
Somebody making a statement to Nikki, it sounds like.
They were scaring her away, yes. And to top it off, there was a man that would be standing out by their house, and he followed them all one day. And she has two daughters, and she had a baby at the time. And he happened to be a child molester. And the officer, what was his name, Leah?
It was Decker. Or no, Utter.
No, Utter. Detective Utter was a good man. Actually, he quit being a detective and went back to street because right after that, he just resigned. When I called him the next time, he said, I'm not going to do this detective work anymore.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is very interesting. Anyway, he said he investigated this guy because the guy had a car and he was following them everywhere. And he's told me, Better told me, that this man was a child abuser.
From Lapine, and the thing was is that he had followed Nikki and the children around all day. I mean, they'd went to eat, they went to the park, this guy is everywhere. When Nikki gets home, telling her husband Buster about it. This man had been at their house and pretended to be looking for somebody else in the neighborhood and had actually engaged Buster in conversation when they compared notes. Nikki had the forethought to get the license plate number, and then Utter finds out that this man is a convicted child molester out of Lapine. And that's not very long after the poster incident. So, you know, again, if it's a simple case of suicide, and we're just being overwrought and high-strung and, you know, living in la-la land, why all this other stuff?
Right. Exactly. And I have to say, too, I'm sure you know this, I know you do, and Veronica, you too, is that the police, there is always going to be some bad apples, some bad things happening. But then again, it's not as if that happens all the time, thank God. Like you were saying, it happens more than we think, but just read that website.
It just happened to me is all, and there were quite a few that got sent to jail, so I'm not sure how many.
Right. In your case, I don't know how many were good either, and I'm not talking about that particular sheriff's department.
I would say Detective Utter was a good man. I would say that.
Yeah, and that's why he stepped down. Yeah, and that's probably why he stepped down. But as far as police and other, you know, around the United States, there are some great detectives and some great police work. But again, that just brings home your point, Rita, is this, if this could happen to you and your mom, it can happen to anyone, anywhere. And, you know, we were both raised in the same era, Rita, and you were raised to trust the police. And, you know, we were talking earlier about the Norman Rockwell painting of a little boy.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that is how we were brought up. That's how we were raised. But you have to, as hard as it is, and Veronica, I don't think I could have done it, to keep your wits about you when something like this happens, and to ask questions. And I don't know, what do you take it from there, Rita? We got about 6 minutes left or so, and I mean, what is someone to do when something like this
happens? Well, that's the bottom line. I mean, the more that the stories get out there, you know, like Rhonda Reynolds' case and Sean Allison and the, you know, other families that have had this happen, we had never heard of anything like this before. It's really kept hush-hush. And so, you know, yes, you'll be stunned. Yes, you'll be shocked. But, you know, God forbid if this does happen in somebody's family and they've, you know, heard this, they will have the presence of mind, you know, maybe not right that second, but an hour, 2 hours, or, you know, whatever, to insist that there's an autopsy, to insist that there's photographs and ballistics. Because after an area is cleaned up and after a body is cremated, it's far too late.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot go back and undo that. It's like toast, you know, bread. Once it's toast, it can never be bread again. So
I've watched enough movies and stuff that I've seen the tough women that go, "You're not taking that body away. I want to see it." And, you know, that's how you should have acted. But I didn't know that you even have the right to do that. I really didn't realize that.
You know, and I guess that's the biggest thing is just, you know, in the event that a loved one has died and it's not from, you know, a terminal disease, if there's any question whatsoever, especially if the police are saying, "Oh, they committed suicide," go, "Well, nobody witnessed it, and here's the statutes for my state, and you will adhere to them as far as autopsy, investigation." And I think, you know, they say that first 48 hours is critical, and it is. It is. But the majority of people, you're stunned by the death. You've never heard that, "Oh, by the way, this, you know, A, B, C, and D needs to be done when a body is found." You're just get in the river and you're just floating along as they lead you, and you can't be like that. You have to get out and stand on the shore and say, "No, I want an autopsy. I want an investigation."
Know your state laws and everything, because you're going to need them.
Mm-hmm. And the more people hear this, the more it will pop into their heads.
And yeah, I mean, if we save one family from the hindsight problem that we're having, then it will be worth it to keep the story alive and out there.
Right. Right. Well, my friend, I've so enjoyed you being on the program, Rita, and Veronica.
Thank
my
you.
Prayers.
Yes,
and
thank you so much.
To you. Oh, it's been my pleasure. And would you perhaps maybe want to come back sometime in the future? I would love to stay in touch with you both. And would you like to come back in the future sometime and keep us updated? I'd love to have you on the show again.
Absolutely. You know, I'm waiting on another report. I've got two more packages to send to a couple different people. My next step is to see what I can do to get the suicide ruling reversed. I mean, we have to do that before we can do anything else. And so, yes, absolutely, I'll keep you apprised of what I'm doing.
Well, thank you so much. And I do want to say thank you to the folks that have joined us this evening. Thank you for coming. Rita, Veronica, they're all saying that they are express their thoughts and prayers to you both.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate them. Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess that's it for this evening. I'm Kim Colton, and thank you for joining us at Seeking Justice. Good night, everyone.
Good night, Kim.
Good night.
Good night.